difficult because it more or less destroys the very roots of the foundation, or the foundation on which we base all of our activities. Everyone is working to be happy, but somehow modern life doesn't make us happy. It gives us the opposite. So, in this presentation, I will try to show that something's actually missing. We are educated in many ways in the modern world, but there's a whole section of something which is missing, and that's why we can never be happy. Okay, next slide. So I call this missing knowledge. We get knowledge in universities, or even in elementary school, or lower standard, upper standard, whatever. You go through school, and you maybe go to classes for 6 hours a day or whatever, and you study another 3 hours. So 20 years, 30 years of your life, you're studying and getting knowledge of some sort. But unfortunately, it doesn't make you happy. You end up with stress. So there's something missing. So there is something, there is a solution, but we don't know what it is. So that's what we call the missing knowledge. And because we have the missing knowledge, we don't know what the real goal of our life is. So that's our missing goal. So we've been searching a long time. Since the beginning of history, everyone is looking for knowledge. And of course, in the modern world, we have so many scientists and others searching. So one way is looking outside. We see with our eyes, and we use our brains, and we analyze things. So for instance, this in one field, we have, of course, so many fields in science, but this is astronomy is one field. They've been looking at the skies with telescopes for hundreds of years and coming up with all sorts of new information we didn't know. And based on that, we make new theories about the universe and how universes are created and how Earth was created, etc. So, as I said, there's a 1995, they sent up the Hubble telescope to take clear pictures of what's in the universe. Because from Earth, we get all the atmosphere interfering, so we don't get very clear pictures at all. So they send a Hubble telescope outside of the atmosphere and orbits around the Earth where there's no atmosphere, and it took pictures of little points in the sky and everything like this, and sent back information on Earth. So these are some of the pictures that came back. And when they saw these pictures, the physicists were actually quite shocked, because this telescope would concentrate on a few inches of sky. And of course, they knew from telescopes, there's some stars up there and whatever. But when the telescope outside of the atmosphere, the Hubble telescope, looked at these and enlarged these images, in one little area of sky, they found millions of galaxies. So then the physicists were shocked, and they understood this universe is much bigger than we thought it was. So these are some of the pictures that were sent back. And if we see one galaxy, it may have billions of suns in it, one single galaxy. And in a few inches of space in the sky, we enlarge that, we'll find millions of galaxies there. So pick the whole sky, and we'll see possibilities are unlimited. How many planets are there? How many suns are there? So this was very shocking to scientists. They understood that we thought the universe was this big, but it's actually much bigger, that it had so many galaxies and so many planets and so many suns and so many stars. But now we know it's much huger, much bigger. So this is apparently the size of the universe. Nobody knows because we can't see, but we have physical theories to explain it. So this is the size, unimaginable size of the universe. So we have this huge universe out there somewhere. And within that, then we got all of these billions of galaxies, and in each galaxy there's billions of stars. And around the stars you got little planets going around. So we can, the possibilities of life are so much in the universe, not just on our Earth. So this is one galaxy, and in this one galaxy, somewhere in there, there's a sun, which is so far apart from every other star in the universe. And around that sun, then we have our Earth planet going. So this is a Earth planet, and we have India, and we have people in India, and we have people in all the cities, etc. And everyone has is going around doing their activities here. So compared to the whole universe, actually, this whole Earth and all the billions of people in here are actually nothing. Very infinitesimal. So that is one explanation of the universe. We're kind of nothing in the whole universe, and then there's theories on how the universe was formed, like from the Big Bang or whatever like that. But what does it mean? Accident. We are here by accident. So it leaves us with no real purpose in life. Why are we here? Sciences, we don't know. It's just accidental. Okay? Now, of course, if we look in the scriptures, in the Puranas, Mahabharata, Ramayana, and other literatures, we'll find we have a whole different description of the universe. It's somewhat similar, but also somewhat different.
Hare Krishna. I just have a small request. Is anybody...
Can they hear?
Everybody can understand?
So we pronounce English. We're fine.
Okay.
You don't need familiar.
No. Okay.
So we have a different conception of the universe. For instance, we have Mount Meru in the center of the universe, and then we have different islands around it and different oceans. This is a traditional diagram of this. And of course, we have the different mandalas and yantras in India, which also represent the whole of everything, that is, the whole universe. And they look very symmetrical, somewhat like a galaxy. They're circular in shape and they have symmetrical proportions. And even the temples of India are based upon this whole idea of universe, a symmetrical universe. This is actually a temple in Cambodia, Angkor Wat, which was actually a Vishnu temple. But temples in India also based on this idea of universe. And of course, central to the idea in all of these things is the lotus flower, which is also a symmetrical image. So the universe is often compared to a lotus flower. So that is modern science has given us one way of getting knowledge by looking outside of telescopes or looking down at some microscopes, etc., and doing physical experiments. But how did the people of India come up with a whole different vision of the universe? Were they just primitive people? Actually, if we look at the works they did, it's not primitive. We find very advanced mathematics there, and a study of the sky, and astronomy, so many other sciences there also, so it wasn't very primitive at all. But how did they get their knowledge? So the process was different. Instead of like outwards, they went inside. So this is what we call yoga. Yoga, of course, means to bring together, to join together, or to unite. So the whole purpose of yoga is to bring about a unity of the universe, the body, the mind, and the soul. As I noted, the modern scientists have a theory of the universe, but it really puts the human being in a little speck of nowhere, not much meaning to it. So what is yoga? There are many, of course, yoga groups today in the modern world, and they have all different sorts of ideas. So we have to ask the question, what is this yoga? And some groups will say, well, physical exercise, we do yoga to be healthy. Or it's a type of gymnastics, some art, or some sport that we can do, and we can have contests to who's better than the next person like that. Or some people say, no, it's not physical at all. We want to get paranormal powers, some special cities, special powers. Or some people want to become detached from the world, so they say it's a type of austerity. So we always see yogis like this up in the Himalayas. So what is yoga, actually? And who can do yoga? Is everybody qualified for yoga? So these questions we have to ask. Actually, in the modern world, they even have yoga for dogs. It's called doga. The dogs also get stressed out and get sick, so they want to make the dogs healthy and peaceful, so they give them doga. And even the cats. If we want to find out what yoga is, then we should go to the original writer on this, Patanjali. He was the first author. He wrote the Yoga Sutras over 2,000 years ago. So in that sutra, he defines eight limbs called astanga, eight parts. The first part is called restraint, yama, in which you have to refrain from certain things. Don't do this, don't do that. No violence, no lying, no stealing, no sex life, no hoarding of goods. These are yamas. And then we have niyamas, positive things you should do, such as being clean, being satisfied, being austere, studying the Vedas, and worshiping God. So these are the first two elements, the rules of conduct. And then we have asana. These are different positions of the body, which are quite famous nowadays. People like to do the asanas. So it's physical manipulation of the body in order so that you can sit properly for meditation. And then we have pranayama, controlling the breath. It's another physical process. And the yogis understood that by controlling the breath, we got certain effects. That is, the mind gets controlled. So it becomes very useful. So after doing this pranayama, you begin to withdraw your senses from objects of this world, that's called pratyahara, and to concentrate on one object inside, that's called dharana. When that concentration becomes continuous, it is called jhana, or meditation. And the final stage is called samadhi. In this state, senses, mind, intelligence all stop. And then what happens? You realize Atman. You realize the self. In other words, everything else, the body and the senses and the mind and intelligence, are all obstacles to understanding who you are. So the process of yoga is stop all of these things, and we end up with Atman. So we see that the first elements are very physical, and then the other ones had to do with the mind, and then finally we came to samadhi with the realization of Atma. So we have physical body, and then we have mental body or subtle body, and then we have spiritual body, Atma. Three things. And the mind is a bridge between the very gross, that's the body, and the soul. So we have body, mind, and soul, with the mind in the middle. This is from the Yoga Sutra. The first sutra actually is, yoga means stopping all the actions of material consciousness. And the last sutra is, liberation is freedom from material qualities and material goals. Liberation is establishment of the self in a spiritual nature. So what this implies is that if you want to understand who you are, you have to reject everything material. Which sounds a little bit, for us, how can we reject the material world? We've got to live, etc. So it sounds a little bit austere and a little frightening to us. But the goal is to ultimate goal is to realize the self. Now, why? Because if we realize who we are, we get peace. We no more stress. We get happiness. And we're not subject to the problems of this material world, birth, sickness, old age, and death. So this is the goal, to get happiness and freedom from all these problems of the world. How? By understanding Atma. So that is the goal of yoga. So in this process, we should just see that there's three different things. We have the gross body, and yoga deals with that with asanas and pranayama. Then we have the next body. This is called the sukshma sarir, or the subtle body. We can't see this one, therefore it's called sukshma. But it's real, it exists. And this is where we have the mind, intelligence, ego, etc. And then we have the third body, that is spiritual body. This is where the Atma resides. So we have three levels of existence. Unfortunately, modern science will only deal with this, and try to make this happen, the gross body. What about the mind? What about the soul? No. That's why we get stressed, because we're neglecting part of ourself. So, actually, in yoga, they understood the body we see is not the only body. And here's a diagram of the different subtle currents in the body called nadis. And these are not nerves, they're not muscles, they're not blood vessels, there's something else you cannot see. But nevertheless, they function and make our body healthy. So the yogis believe there's another body here, which also has to do with our health, but we can't see it. And of course, we know there is various chakras on the body also that are known in yoga. There's a diagram. But we can't see those. If you look, you can't see them. If a doctor operates on you and opens up your spine and looks there, you won't find chakras like this also. But nevertheless, in the scriptures, these are described in great detail. We'll wonder, is that real or not? So, can we prove the subtle body exists? Can we prove the mind really exists or not? So, some scientists have also taken up this task and researched the mind also. But one thing is obvious, that we obviously know that the mind is very powerful, because this distinguishes human being from animal. What's the difference? We have a stronger mind than animals. And because of that mind, we have civilizations. So in the past, we see great civilizations in China and Egypt and Greece and whatever, India, many different civilizations. How did that come about? We don't see dogs and cats having a civilization. We have no history of civilizations for dogs and cats and birds, no. So human beings have had these different civilizations. Why? Because highly developed mind. So therefore, mind is very powerful. It can do a lot for the human being. It's a source of creation. But simultaneously, we find that it's a source of greater destruction. So the civilizations create so many wonderful things, but they're also responsible for more destruction than animals can do. So we've never heard of a World War I or World War II of the cats or dogs. But we have World War I, World War II, and so many other wars of human beings in which millions of people are killed. People killing people. So we don't see that dog killing dog like that. Maybe one dog fights with another. But we don't see mass extinction of dogs by dogs. We never see that. But we see it in human beings. Why? Because we're more advanced? Doesn't sound proper. If we're more advanced and are intelligent, we shouldn't do that. So, yes, the mind is advanced in one way, but it's also very dangerous. So, this we have to think about. So, scientists have analyzed the mind in different ways. This one study was done by Hal Putoff. He's a physicist in America, a famous one. You look on the internet, you'll find this. He's still alive and he's still doing research, etc. And he was assigned to study the mind. Its extrasensory perception and paranormal powers, is it true or not? So he was hired by the military to do this in America. So he got tons of funds to do this. So he's a scientist, and he set up very precise experiments to prove or disprove it. He was not a believer, so he set up some very critical experiments to see if people could do it or not. So we had one guinea pig, so to speak. Ingo Swann was a natural clairvoyant in America, and he used him, tested him mainly. And after many, many, many experiments, then he said, despite the ambiguities inherent in the type of exploration covered in these programs, integrated results appear to provide unequivocal evidence of a human capacity to access events remote in space and time, however falteringly, by some cognitive process not yet understood. So in other words, he says, this person, when he studied him, was able actually to travel with his mind to very distant places, 5,000 miles away in less than a second, gather information and come back. He could go anywhere in the world, he could go to the moon, he could go to Jupiter, he could go anywhere in the universe, split of a second, and come back with information. That's what he's saying here in this statement. Of course, he says, faltering, what he says, but we see that there was 85% accuracy in his results, this person's results. He got 85% accuracy, even going to Jupiter. Before they could send a probe up to Jupiter, he went to Jupiter in his mind and brought that information about the atmosphere and the temperature and the surface of Jupiter. 10 years later, a probe got there, sent from Earth, 10 years it took to get there. And then it began sending information back about the atmosphere of Jupiter, and 85% correct. But it took 10 years for the probe to go there. He went there 1 second, 10 years previously. So in other words, quite accurate, and you do this with the mind. So as a result, he says, the physicist Halpudov says, we can't explain it, but we have to take the mind into account in any analysis of the real world. The mind is real. It's a real thing. It's not imaginary. It's not hypnosis to make trick people. The mind has special powers. This is one experiment. He was just given a number, a random number of light. Then he was told, okay, describe what's behind this number. So then he relaxed. And then he drew these two diagrams. One is a map, and one is a picture of a machine. These are the two things he got from that number. So it turns out the number represented a place in Siberia. He was in America. Siberia is about, 3,000 or 4,000 miles away. So the target was Siberia, a particular town there, or installation. It was actually a secret installation built by Russia. And the government of America wanted to know what they're doing there, because it's all secret. Some secret thing they're doing. This is when the Cold War was on, and he went and he made this diagram of the place, the map, and the machine. So later they sent a spy satellite over Russia and photographed Siberia, and they could magnify everything, and they took a photograph of this place. And this is actually what was there. So again, you see that the machine, he drew the machine, and he drew a diagram of the place. But nobody knew what it was until later. He got the information first. Later they sent the spy satellite over to the photograph. So he couldn't cheat. So he got accurate information this way. So this is the power of the mind. I probably don't have time to just skip this one. So there's been experiments with moving objects with the mind also. Can we move objects? This would show that the mind is real, that it has physical force behind it. So in America, they did experiments like this. And they also did this in China. In China, they have some people who are, they practice Qigong, which is like yoga, and they develop some very, very great powers. So in one experiment, a person combined hydrogen and carbon monoxide to get carbon dioxide, which takes usually a very high temperature of 300 degrees and 30 atmospheres pressure under physical circumstances. So he did this with his mind. He was able to generate this energy and produce carbon dioxide. There was another person called Bao Sheng. So he actually did many, many amazing things. In one demonstration, for instance, he was able to move a sack of sugar weighing 45 kgs with his mind through a brick wall. Just with his mind. And the sugar came on one side of the wall and it came to the other side. So in other words, he passed matter through matter, which nobody can do, even physically today. So very, very far out. In another experiment, they put a bug in a sealed glass tube. And with his mind, he got the bug out. Yeah, like that. And the bug was still alive. And the glass wasn't broken. So how did he do that? How did he get the bug out of the jar with his mind without breaking the glass? So they got a camera that goes like 300 frames per second or something. And he did it again. And the camera was taking photographs 300 frames per second. And then in three pictures, they found the bug passing through the glass. So in other words, he was able to pull matter through matter with his mind. So how is it possible? So 30 scientists in China investigated this. And therefore, the conclusion is that somehow the mind has very great power to do things that are normally not possible at all, such as passing matter through matter. Okay. So what is the mind? We don't know what the mind is. So we're just beginning to study the mind. You see a few experiments done and a few researchers are working on the mind, but nevertheless, they appreciate the power of the mind. So in the Bhagavad Gita, we also have the mind as a topic of discussion. It comes up quite often. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you should deliver yourself with the help of the mind and not degrade yourself. That the mind is your friend to help you go up, and it's your enemy to help you go down. So the mind can go either way. It's very powerful, but it can help you progress or degrade. And the mind is so powerful, it creates destinations for you. What you think of, you become. So if you think of something very strongly when you die, you can become that in your next life. So there's the story of Bharat. He was very affectionate towards a deer. And when he died, he was thinking of the deer. And next lifetime, he became a deer. So this is the strength of the mind. It creates your body for you. So we would say, oh, that's in the Puranic story, but how do we know that's true? But we do have some correlation in the modern world. There's one doctor in America called Ian Stevenson. He wrote a huge book on his investigation of children who remember previous lifetimes. So he did study about 1,000 cases personally. And he was atheist, so he very critically rejected questionable cases, whatever. But still, he found cases which you could not reject, in which they were accurate memories of previous lifetimes. And then he also found that the persons in the previous lifetime, if they died in an accident and got injuries on their body, those injuries carried over into their next body and left birthmarks. So for instance, one boy in India, he remembers previous lifetime in another village 100 miles away, he was shot by a shotgun in the chest. And so a shotgun has many little pellets in it, so there's many holes there. And it was recorded by the police. This is the autopsy report of the police. They have the body there, and there's a big hole in the middle, right near the heart, and there's all these little holes, little wound holes from the other shots. And that's previous lifetime. When the boy was born this lifetime, he had this strange mark on his chest. One mark in the middle, and little marks around it. And his parents often wondered, what is this mark on his chest? And then when he was 4 or 5 and he could speak, then he began telling about his previous lifetime, where he was shot in the chest, etc. So in other words, the wounds of his death got impressed on his next body, not by genetics, because the families are not related. Previous family and this family not related at all. So somehow, through his mind, the impression carried over into the next body. So there's many examples of that. So what I'm saying is this is, Bhagavad Gita says, what you think of when you die, you become. So we have that proof there in that people, when they die, they have certain accidents. Those accidents are reflected in their next body and they leave traces. Okay, so the mind is also described in the Bhagavad Gita as being limiting, because with the mind you get pushed around here and there, as if you were a boat on the water pushed by the wind. The mind leads you here, leads you there, all over the place. The mind is powerful to lead you up, but it's also very unsteady, it can be very unsteady. So therefore, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you must control the mind by all means. If you want to progress in life, you have to control the mind. So we may think, well, I'll work very hard, whatever, but actually, more important than the body is the mind. But also, Krishna Bhagavata says another thing, that we have the body and the senses, higher than that is the mind, higher than the mind is intelligence, and higher than the intelligence is the Atma, the soul. So not only do we have to take into consideration controlling the mind, we also have to consider the soul, because that's the highest element of all. So we should not forget, as I said before, that this is, we usually concentrate on the body. But then we have higher than that, we have the mind, which Krishna says you must control, and higher than that, we have the soul. So we have to be aware of these other elements of the body as well as the gross physical body. So how we begin to control the mind? Essentially what we have to do is develop higher taste. If we have a taste for one thing which is not beneficial for us, for instance, some people get attracted to alcohol or smoking or whatever, and it's bad for the health and bad for the mind. So how do you get rid of that? Have to develop a different taste, higher taste, something more attractive. So that is the principle of controlling the mind. We have to develop a higher taste. Higher than the mind is the Atman, so therefore we have to develop spiritual taste. Okay, this will be a little practical. How to control the mind. So first we have to do two things. One is talk about creating choice for the mind. And the other is to, once we make the choices, achieve them. So the mind is important in both things. How to make choices and how to achieve those choices or those goals. So, unfortunately, as I said, the mind is uncontrolled, and we're controlled by the mind, whatever we think, we go that direction. So usually these are ingrained habits, and it's very, very difficult to change this once they're established. We can't fight against them. We're just controlled by different desires. Somehow we have to get control. If we don't get control, then there's no hope of change, no hope of real choices at all. We get forced to go in one direction. So between the, what we have coming in, we have stimuli coming in through the senses into the mind, and then mind takes all that stimuli and responds somehow or other. So usually it all goes in, and due to habit, we get an automatic response, good or bad, all based upon previous impressions and habits. And it's automatic, more or less. No choice involved. But the idea is that when all this information goes in, we actually should make a choice. So in other words, between the stimuli and the response, there's an opportunity to choose. So usually by habit, stimuli come in, automatically we react. No choice. And the other way of doing it is stimuli come in, then we think very carefully. And we carefully choose based upon sets of values. Then we act. That is the proper way of doing things. So when we become responsible for choosing, when we do that, then we can actually choose our goal in life and achieve those goals. This is how we change our lives. Otherwise, everything is habit. We're just doing things previously the same way we did before, making similar choices. So more or less, we're forced into a certain position. No choice at all. So if we want to progress and make change, we have to really choose. We have to slow down this process, and when the stimuli come in, we have to think very carefully before we choose. So, usually we think, I behave like this because this is what's happening around me. My circumstances control me. The weather's like this, then I feel like this. The weather's like that, I feel like that. So, we're controlled by our circumstances. But it shouldn't be like that. We should be able to control our decisions, and this creates our future. We should not be controlled by the conditions themselves. So we should subordinate our feelings and our reactions to our surroundings to our values within. So the inside, what's inside you, is more important than what's outside. Some people are called reactive. They don't make choices. They react to their feelings, and their feelings are based upon circumstances, like and dislike. So immediately, they have a reaction. This is not choice. So we're more or less out of control. Every time a certain event happens, for a certain type of event, then we do the same, get the same reaction like this. No thought process, we just react. So if we do this all the time, we'll never change. We'll repeat the same patterns throughout life. So this is very hopeless for the human being. As I said, the mind, it can drag you down or it can elevate. If you want to elevate, then we have to start controlling and making proper choices. If we don't do that, then basically we'll be degraded. So, these habits we have to change. So the opposite of a reactive person is a proactive person. So proactive people, they first of all have values, very strong values, which they consider very carefully inside themselves. So they're very, very integral to their being. They have very, very strong values. And on this basis, they make their decisions, not upon dislike or dislike based on information coming in and reacting. So values that come from outside, you have to do this, have to be like this, whatever, that is superficial. It helps to some degree, but actually, no. Because if there's no force put on you, ultimately, you go back to your other method of choice again. So actually, the values have to come from deep within inside. You must have very strong conviction in certain values. Based on that, and then you can change things. So in life, we choose all the time. So I'm choosing so many things in life. But if we analyze it, actually, it's not much choice we're making at all. These things, we make choices in our mind, and these become the center of our lives. But what are the things? One is marriage. Choose marriage. That's one. Very famous one. Everybody gets involved in this one. So that's one choice. Now there is family. Have family. So you become involved with family, raising children. In order to do that, you need money. So you become money-centered. We need money. How do we get the money? And then we have to work. We have a job, and we become job-centered. So all of these become very, very time-consuming. We have to spend time on all of these things to develop all of these things. And then, of course, along with this, we got to get a little bit of comfort so we get to buy things and we get possessions to hold on to. And then to relax so we get pleasure. And then we have friends or enemies. So these are actually centers of our life. But the choices we make here are nothing very special because everybody does this. Everybody in the whole world, these are the choices everybody makes. Okay, but of course choosing which spouse or which friend or whatever, that's a choice. But these are the very, very common goals that everybody chooses. It's nothing special. In fact, even animals to some degree are making choices like that. So it's nothing special for the human being. Human beings should make higher choices than this. So as I said, a lot of these things deal with this, the girl's body, the choices and our goals. What about the mind? What about soul? No choices there for the soul and for getting rid of the stresses in life and whatever in your mind. These things are not dealt with at all. We're taught only to deal with the material body. Therefore, we end up in a stressful position in life. So I mentioned internal goals. So we have to ask questions like, who am I? What are my real needs and desires, apart from eating and having a house and all these things, which is common for everybody? Do I have other needs or desires? What will really satisfy me? What is my real nature? What are the principles by which I live? These questions, generally, we don't ask. But these are the ones we should ask. Because on this basis, we establish values upon which we can actually act properly and free ourselves from habits. So ultimately, as I said, the center, the highest center is the Atma, not the body. Not the body is not the center of everything. And even the mind isn't the center, but ultimately the Atma is the center. If we base ourselves on the Atma and establish values in the Atma, eternal values there, automatically we have power. Power, this means here, the power to decide our future. We get wisdom. We can see things not from a localized view, from a very broad vision. Guidance means we don't have to ask other people what to do. We have internal guidance inside ourselves because of our values. And security. Normally people are insecure. They have a fear of circumstances, of time, etc. But if we have eternal principles, we can apply these any circumstance, any time. It doesn't matter. And in any case, those principles will work. So we're free of that fear of future. So if we have low sense of security without, we feel helpless. If we have high sense of security, we have confidence to face the world. If we have low sense of guidance, we depend on others for advice. We have to ask everybody what to do, what to do, what to do. And if we have high sense of guidance, we get inner direction. If we have high sense of wisdom or low sense of wisdom, we have a distorted vision of the world. We think in a very, very prejudiced way. And if we have high wisdom, we have a very accurate vision of the world. We can see all points of view. If we have a low sense of power, we don't want to do anything. So let somebody else do it. I can't do this. And if we have a high sense of power, then we create our future. And we can create the future of others. Okay, so I dealt with the choice. We have to choose properly based upon choosing internal values first. Then, once we choose goals, the mind is very useful in achieving the goals. So the principle is, first you have to have mental creation. If that is strong, then we have physical manifestation. So there's two creations of an object. In the mind, and then in the outside world. So that's your goal. You have an internal goal. You have to have it very strong in your mind. When it's strong in your mind, it is achieved in this world. If it's not strong in your mind, you don't achieve it. So this is a very basic principle. Yeah? Of course, this was already explained in Bhagavad Gita, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body attains that. So, whatever you think of, that's what you get. Even not only next life, but in this life by myself. So if you think strongly of something, you can attain that. If you don't think strong, you don't get it. So therefore, if you have goals, you have to be serious about them. You have to meditate upon them. Yeah? Then you can achieve them. There's a story of one person in America. So he had, I think, $97 in the bank. So he said, my goal is to make $1 million in 1 year. Wouldn't that be nice, everybody? Give me $1 million in 1 year. So he said, okay, now let's apply this principle. Mental creation. So he took a $1 bill, and he took a pen. And after the one, he put 6 zeros, 1 million. And then he took some tape. And he got up with a ladder. And above his bed on the ceiling, he taped the $1 bill with the 6 zeros after it. So every morning when he woke up, he looked up the ceiling, he would say, $1 million. So every morning, he would think, $1 million. He would get out of bed, brush his teeth, he would think, $1 million, $1 million. So all day he would think, $1 million like this. And when he was looking around outside, then he would get ideas, how am I making this $1 million like this? He was a writer, actually. So then he went to the store, and then he looked at the store, $1 million, I'm going to make this. And I thought, I got a good idea. I will put this book in all the stores where they get supermarkets in America. They have counters, and they have books and candies and all this there at the checkout counter. And so I said, I'll put my book in all these stores. Everybody will buy it. So he got all sorts of ideas like this on how to sell his book. So he was thinking like this all day. And after 1 year, he had almost $1 million in the bank. He sold the book. And people bought it because he was thinking about how to write the book and how to sell the book. So after 1 year of thinking like this, he actually achieved his goal. And so, and that's just one example. So the problem is that we may have goals, but a lot of it is daydreaming. Yeah? We don't think strongly enough, so therefore we don't achieve them. So why do most endeavors fail? Because that first creation in the mind is not strong. We may think about it once a week or once a month or once a year. That means useless. It won't happen. Yeah? The mind becomes too distracted. Therefore, we have to discipline the mind and concentrate on our particular goals. Yeah? So that is why Krishna Bhagavad Gita says that it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and detachment. So practice is necessary. So if you want to achieve a goal, you have to think about it every day. Then you can achieve it. So this is summarized. We want to change things. You want a better life for ourselves, or our family, or the country, or whatever, world. So how to do it? First change is with the self. You got to understand the self. That has to be the center of change. Understand who you are. So don't work on the lower end, which is changing things in the world or trying to change your body. It begins with understanding yourself. So change is possible. It takes effort. Everything takes effort. To graduate from college takes effort. You've got to study or something. Get a job to get money. You have to work. That takes effort. So if you want change in your life, real change in your life, that also takes effort. So practice is necessary. Daily drill yourself with new ideas, new paradigms, new goals. So it's possible, more easier to change ourselves than change others. Usually we'll think, well, that person should change. But that's never going to happen. It's easier to change ourselves. When we change ourselves, then we can change other people. If we don't change, nothing's going to happen. So we have to become responsible for our decisions and actions. We don't just run on the idea of reaction. Let's react to every event around me. No, we should be responsible for our decisions. Very carefully think about it, and then we act. In this way, we begin to change ourselves and we change the world. So we should choose our goals with intelligence and imagination, and then we have to focus on them. The goals must include acting according to the eternal principles by which we live. That means the values in the soul itself. Some things we can't change in the material world. So what do? We just have to accept that as grace of God. If we change ourselves, then we can change others. And when we set goals, we should set goals which do not interfere with other persons. In other words, they should be beneficial for everybody, not just for ourselves. If we do that, then we can achieve our goals. So we can, in terms of what should I choose, this or that or whatever, then we can analyze this very simply in terms of some basic principles. The law of attraction. This is one law. What's in your mind, that becomes reality. You think good things happen. Think bad things happen. Think good goals, you get those goals. You think the opposite, you're negative all the time, you don't get anything. That's the first thing. Mind is very powerful, and you have to use it properly. Second is the law of karma. When you do set goals, you have to make sure that they do not interfere with others, they don't create violence. Because violent action will produce opposite reaction. If you, to get your goal, you cause violence to others, in the future you'll get the violence back on yourself. So therefore, whatever you gain, you lose the gain. It's the law of karma. The law of responsibility. The more responsibility we take for our decisions by controlling the mind, the more we can get free from the law of karma. We get free from this. Responsibility means that we're very careful in how we handle ourselves in this material world and interact with other living entities. The law of change. We want to change ourselves, and by changing ourselves, we change the world. So this means that we're not selfish, but change in ourselves actually will affect the whole world. So we have to develop a responsibility for the whole world. And the law of choice. We choose from our internal values. So as a subset of this, we can ask some simple questions. So what should I choose, this or that? So on the physical level, very simple. If I do this, is it good for my health or bad for my health? For instance, should I eat this particular food? Is it good for my health or bad for my health? Make a decision. If it's good for the health, do it. Bad for the health, don't do it. The mental level, higher level. If I do this activity, it's going to create happiness and become stress-free, or it's going to create more stress and depression for me. So if it creates less stress and better happiness, let's do it. And third, on the intellectual level, is it truthful or not? Is it full of lies and stuff? Don't do it. If it is truthful, let me do it. Will it create beauty in the world, or will it destroy the world and make it ugly? If it creates beauty in the world, then do it. If it creates the opposite, don't do it. And the most important one of all, unconditional love. Will it create unconditional love in myself and other people, or will it do the opposite? If it does, do it. If it doesn't, don't do it. So this is the highest level. The first level, health, was body. And then we get the mind and intelligence, etc. Then, finally, we get Atman here. The highest level is, the quality of Atman is this unconditional love. So if it creates unconditional love, do it. So if we get yes, 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 yes for all of these, then do it. If you get no's, no's, don't do it. So very, very simple technique. This is how we can settle everything in terms of choice. But to actually do that and act according to that will require some strength on your part. So we talked about knowledge and what was missing in the material world. We look out here and get things, all types of scientific knowledge, but ultimately it doesn't really answer questions for us. And the other knowledge that we get from the Vedas and the scriptures is actually something that comes from inside. It talks about the Atman and or the soul and the values of the soul. And if we do that, we actually get satisfaction because we're covering all of reality, whereas science only covers one aspect, the material realm. It doesn't get to the mental or to the spiritual level. So by going to scriptures, we can ultimately concentrate on developing the Atma or the soul, and by doing that, we can get happiness on the mental and on the physical level as well. So this way we have a unity between the body, the mind, and the soul, and the universe, all based on the principle of unconditional love. So that is yoga. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Our mind is quite mature compared to animals and stuff. And you also mentioned that when we die, whatever thought is strong enough for our next life, that is what we'll become. So if we're progressing from animals and stuff and becoming human, how is it that after becoming human, we go backward?
Okay. How do we decrease if we're supposed to be progressing as human beings? So the answer is, as human beings, we don't always progress. We do wars, we cause millions of deaths. That's not progress. So in other words, as a human being, we misuse our choices and we do a lot of violent or sinful activity. So if we get absorbed in all of this violent activity, then we lose our chance to be a human being and we go back to animals. Therefore, we don't have any responsibility or choice anymore. That when we misuse our choice and we do all sorts of irresponsible activities, then we get the animal species. Then we don't have to choose anymore. We just act as animals, no intelligence.
Next person, okay.
That's all?
Sometimes students, when they're studying in colleges, universities, they're all like youngsters, and they sometimes come to a question, can we really follow all this? Because we want to have a mission in life, There are so many things, and this looks like ancient thing. Now modern science increase. How do you apply all this in this particular modern age?
Well, the point is that in the modern world, as I said, yes, we have all sorts of material goals to set for ourselves, and we're told we have to achieve this and have to achieve that. But the end result in a lot of cases is you may achieve that, but you're not satisfied with it. So therefore, you end up with stress in life. Or you can even get nervous breakdowns and some of the other problems because of this. So getting all these material things and thinking you have to have all these material things is also a sort of pressure, artificial pressure put on us. But the most important thing is the Atma itself. That's the self. And if you don't take care of the needs of the self, everything else ends up as a zero anyway. And then when you die, then you'll feel, oh, I lost a chance. I did all the wrong things in this lifetime, and I'm dying now. So, and nobody wants to feel like that when they die. I just messed up this whole life, and I ended up at the end of my life, didn't achieve anything. Maybe I got some money, maybe I got a house, maybe I got a car. What's that? You leave it all when you die. So you're without anything, you're alone again. So in order to prevent that type of feeling, to get real satisfaction, we do have to spend some time. This doesn't mean we spend all the time. No, we have to take care of the body, we have to maintain the body, whatever, and the needs of family, so many things are there. But at least we have to dedicate some time in a day or a week to spiritual things. Otherwise, we're going to end up in a very bad condition ultimately.
Hare Krishna, the students who are sitting here, they want to have more information. Know about the self or reincarnation. We have a nice center in Injimakam, PCR Road. Every Sunday between 11 and 2, we have programs, classes, seminar. Devotees and the students who know the party, please maybe give the address card to you. You are always welcome there.
So here we close the program. And thank you, sir, for your wonderful speech. We really had a nice time. Thank you very much. Fill the feedback form and give it to Swamiji. Thank you.